I want to start in Israel this hour. I want to show you a couple of things. Now, Israel is called monstrous because they are blowing up buildings and killing people. Okay. Israel says, well, we call them. We give them an hour to get out of the building. We alert. Okay. The same thing that the United States did. We dropped 70 million notices all over the major cities in Japan and named, I think, 10 cities where we might drop the world's most powerful bomb. We said we had it. They knew what those air raids had done over in Europe. And we said we have one bomb that will do more damage than all of the firebombings that were done in Germany. So please get out of these cities. We sent 70 million notes. Please. It's coming. It's coming to one of these, I think, 10 or 7 cities. And there will be a shortage of food, of water. Get your families out. We are not trying to destroy you. But these cities are part of your military-industrial complex, and we will destroy them. Please surrender. And if your government doesn't surrender, this is what's going to happen. Get out of those cities. Nobody ever talks about that. Nobody ever does that, except for Israel. What did you hear the Ayatollah in Iran say? By the way, we're gonna bomb. Oh, by the way, we're sending in terrorists. No, they don't do that. Nobody does that. Israel is being blamed and called a monster. They just released an audio clip of them calling a building owner, saying, "We're going to bomb your building. You need to get everyone out." This isn't the first call. This is the second call. I want you to listen, and I'll translate for you. That is the Palestinian. That is the Israeli. Okay, now I want to translate what they're saying. The Palestinian says, "I can't get all of the people out. I need at least 2 hours to get them out." The Israeli says, "Listen, we are going to bomb the building. You want to bomb? Bomb whatever you want. No, brother. We need to do everything we can so you and other people don't die. We want to die, but you have a responsibility for children's lives. If the children need to die, then they'll die. God forbid, God forbid. Why do you want to die?" Now tell me that Israel is the bad guy? If children need to die, then they'll die? Okay. Where does that kind of philosophy come from? Hear me, America. I told you probably 15 years ago, what is being done to us is exactly what has been done to the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, and I realized this on my first trip to Israel. I went to Israel and I was in the old city, and it's all quartered. So there's a Palestinian section, there's a Jewish section. And when you're walking through it, because it's one small city, you're walking through it, and it's like how in America you can go from the suburbs and it's nice, and then it slowly starts to get more trash on the highway and it starts to get broken down. And then if you keep driving a while later, you're in the slums. In Israel, in the old city of Jerusalem, because it's so small and it's so old and a walled city, you take 3 steps, literally, and you're in the slum. And so it goes from beautiful, bright, clean, well-maintained, you walk through one archway, and you're in a dirty, dingy, broken-down part. And the first time I was in that's the Palestinian section of Jerusalem, and I'm walking through, and it's dark and dingy and dirty and uncomfortable. And I walk through an archway, literally, just an archway. I walk through the archway, and all of a sudden it's bright and clean and upscale stores, and it's like it's a different, entirely different place. And I stopped and I said to my guide, what just happened? Where are we? Why is this so different than what is 6 feet behind me? And the guide said, this is the Israeli section. That's the Palestinian section. So I realized that in many cases, being in the slums is a state of mind. Not in all cases, but in the case of the Palestinians, for sure. The Palestinians have been told, don't cooperate with the Israelis. Don't go to work for an Israeli. They're holding you back. They're keeping you down. Israel knows the whole world is against them. The whole world doesn't want to work with the Jews. The whole world has tried to kill them 19 times in Holocausts. They know. They've just went, you know what? So then I have to count on myself. And they get the job done. And I realize it's very similar to what we have going on here in America. You have those people who are trying to keep people down by saying, you know, who's them over there? You need me because those guys, oh, they'll kill you. They're trouble over there. They want your children to starve. They don't care about your children. They don't care about schools. They don't care about crime. In fact, the police are part of it. That's what happens in Israel. That's what's happening here. We are being balkanized. We are being split apart because of our politicians and because of our media. If we didn't have media, social media like we had right now, I contend none of this would be further. It would be moving, but we would be a much different place and be in a much better place. It's just moving at hyper speed. Because it's everywhere now. If you think there's a problem with critical race theory, but you don't want to get involved, let me show you when politics takes over schools, this is what happens to your children. Here are two kids, Palestinian kids, and they want to recite a poem about the Jews. And here it is. I'll translate. Listen to them. Two little girls, probably 6 years old. Okay, here's what they're saying. You can turn it down just a bit, let it run. I do not fear the rifle because your throngs are in delusion and ignorant herds. That sounds like a six-year-old. Jerusalem is my land. Jerusalem is my honor. Jerusalem is my days and my wildest dreams. Oh, you who murdered Allah's pious prophets. Oh, you who were brought up on spilling blood. You have been doomed to humiliation and hardships. Oh, sons of Zion on most evil among creations. Oh, barbaric monkeys and wretched pigs. Jerusalem is not your den. Jerusalem opposes your throngs. Jerusalem vomits from within it your impurity, because Jerusalem, your impure ones, is pious, immaculate. And Jerusalem, you who are filth, is clean and pure. I do not fear barbarity as long as my heart is in my Quran and my city. As long as I have my arms and my stories, as long as I am free, I do not have to barter my cause. I will not fear your throngs. I will not fear the rifle. Where do you get that? You think mom and dad are at home teaching them? I think maybe some places, yeah, sure, some homes are doing that. But for the most part, that's what they get in schools. Their school books are all like this. Once you politicize your school, you get a little Hitler Youth. Where do you think the Palestinians got these tactics? From Adolf Hitler. That's not hyperbole. That's fact. The Palestinians' Grand Mufti of the 1930s was all about Adolf Hitler because they could kill Jews. And that's what the Palestinian Authority wanted, to kill Jews. That's why Hamas, it's in its charter, kill all the Jews. That's why the Grand Mufti had plans of building concentration camps and furnaces, ovens, and gas chambers all over Palestinian land. That's what's coming. That's what's happening. That's what's now happening on our streets.
Heard you guys talking a little bit about the UFO situation. Am I the only one that thinks it's really crazy that that's not a front page story? It's not leading every newscast right now. Is the Pentagon's acceptance and admittance that they're real, they're here, we don't know what they are? It seems like there should be more discussion about it, doesn't it?
Right.
I played
it's
a
like,
guy.
You know, it's. I don't know if what's worse. Thinking that people don't care, mm-hmm. or the fact that when I tell people, they say the same thing. Wait a minute.
What?
When did the Pentagon say this?
Yeah.
I don't know. They've been saying it for a while now. What are you talking about?
Which goes to the lack of coverage on it. I played a guy on my show yesterday who's from who did research for the Pentagon that was researching this phenomenon for a long time. And he was describing a vehicle that travels 13,000 miles an hour, has no obvious form of propulsion, that has no exhaust, that doesn't have wings. We don't know how it's flying in the air, but it can go through the air or under the ocean at about the same
and
speed.
And in space. Yeah. The medium in which it is flying through doesn't seem to affect it at all.
So that's clearly...
There's no vehicle that we know.
That's clearly not from this planet, right? Because it's obviously not ours. You talked to a guy who said we're trying to reverse engineer some of the things that we've found from unidentified flying objects.
Working with the Pentagon in an open public-private partnership, working with the Pentagon to take some of the things that they have at the Pentagon that we have retrieved and trying to reverse engineer it. We apparently have parts of ships. We have parts of things that did not come from Earth, as they described it. They said they've never seen the chemical compounds before. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to make this alloy that these ships are made out of. And their job with the Pentagon is to try to reverse engineer it. How did this come to be? And they haven't been able to find out yet. And Stu, what does it say about us? Because I really can't get my arms around this. I think it's the most important story of my family's lifetime. I mean, the lifetime of my entire family tree. And nobody seems to really either know about it or care. Nobody's following this story.
The only thing I can really take from it is that we've had such a long training, basically, as a population of UFO stories not being real. You know, like everyone has so long been trained that, like, you hear these reports.
Weather
and,
balloons.
And it kind of.
Swamp gas.
Yeah. And even if they are, maybe some of those were real, right? But we've been so long trained to just be like, all right, I mean, UFOs again. Yeah,
but we were trained. Yeah. We were trained by the government and the Pentagon.
That it
wasn't
real.
The people who are admitting it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm with you, and I am surprised it's not a bigger story. There are a lot of other things going on. I mean, that could be it as well. Things that feel more urgent because we haven't seen a laser strike down into a tower like Independence Day yet. But like, it's hard. And some of these stories, by the way, we should point out, some of these videos are from several years ago. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, there's a
They admitted on 60 Minutes that they are tracking them every day.
Yeah, he said every day for a few years.
The guys that were on said,
amazing.
These are over our military and naval bases and over the continent, over things like Cheyenne Mountain, every day. And they said they are, they think that they are hovering there and doing these things because they want to let us know, don't pick a fight with us. I mean, we know everything, and we know where your resources are. We know. So we're here, we're watching. And I wonder why are they doing this?
One skeptical argument I've seen in a few places is why would these only be occurring on U.S. airspace? Why only? I mean, is it just our ability to detect them better? Is it
no? Well, it is our ability. We have new tracking systems. I'm sure the Chinese or the Russians will have something similar to this, but that's why we say we're admitting it now, is we never had the 3-point triangulation. We couldn't get more than one system to track it, and they're moving so fast that we couldn't track, that we couldn't lock onto them. Now we can lock onto them and follow them wherever they go.
Yeah,
so we have real tracking ability now.
You saw the footage of that one little dot that was being tracked by fighter pilots, and then it shot off the screen. It was picked up by the naval vessel a few seconds later, 60 miles away. 60 miles in a matter of a few seconds. So, yeah, they're capable of incredible speed and agility, and it's things that this can't be Russians or the Chinese. If they had that kind of technology, I think we'd already be under their control, wouldn't we? You can't.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine that it comes from
the thing is
that
they also they have, one of the more compelling stories I've heard is the military does exercises. The fighter jets go out and they dogfight. And I don't remember where they were, in the Mediterranean or something, and they were dogfighting. And there is a point that is like a safe zone, and only the pilots know it. They're given in the briefing that there's a safe zone, and it is one specific point in the map, and it's verbally given. And not over the radio, in the room, in the briefing room, right before they go out. So they launched all the planes off the aircraft carriers. They got into a dogfight, and one of the planes was shadowed by this object. And they started tracking it everywhere, and it started to dogfight with it. And there was nothing the plane could do to be able to keep up with its maneuvers. And they thought, they're not playing with us. They're teaching us. They're teaching us you don't have a chance. And so it dogfought for a while, and then the other planes, and then it went immediately to the exact point, which was the safe space.
Right.
And again, the Navy walked away with the message, they know everything. I don't know how they knew that, but it wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a coincidence that it went to that exact location. They were sending the message, not only can we outmaneuver you, we know what you're doing.
Well,
now, yeah. Why would it do that for years and then not introduce itself?
Maybe they've got, the Star Trek principle going for them. The non-intervention thing.
They blew it.
Yeah.
They blew it. Because they shouldn't be seen then.
That's kind of like the question everybody always had. Why don't they land in Washington, D.C.? And,
Oh, and please take our politicians.
Yes.
Wouldn't you? I would be so relieved if you got up and you saw on television, people of Earth, we have taken over the planet and taken all of your politicians. We're now in charge. I think everybody would go, oh, thank God.
Oh, there is some hope, yes. After all. Yeah,
there is a God. He's listening to us. There is hope. Can I ask one more question? What do you think happens to a majority of people's faith? Mine is solid because I believe that, there are aliens. I believe that we're not alone in the universe.
Me too.
But a lot of people still kind of believe that we're unique. And
that we're
I
the
think
only
their
ones.
Faith would be. Do you think that would shake people's faith?
I think some, yeah. Because like you said, I think some people believe we're alone and we're the only ones that were created, I guess.
Do you believe that, Stu? You don't believe that, do you?
No. I wouldn't say that I've thesis on this. Honestly, I've not examined. I've never believed that there's nothing else. But I mean, I have never also tied it into like, let me cross reference this on the Bible and see what, you know. I just haven't gone that way.
I don't think the Bible talks about any of it.
No, but I mean, there are people with faith. You know, there's some people who, you know, look at, you know, religious texts and say like, absolutely not, we're the only ones here. And some people say, no, you know, like it doesn't rule that out. I really don't know what, frankly, well enough to know what the answer to that is. I mean, my impression is that it does not rule it out. But I know there are people.
What an incredible waste of space.
Yeah.
No kidding.
If we're alone.
No kidding.
What a waste.
And I think there's, an infinite number of worlds that have been created with people on them.
Have to be.
Yeah.
Have to be.
But I think they probably, I don't buy the big heads and the green skin thing. I think they'd look like us. I think they're probably created in his image just like we were.
I'm kind of the view that we're all, like, the earth is basically like an atom. Mm-hmm. And we're more of a much larger, there's like a cool robot that we're actually part of. We're just swimming around inside the molecular structure of a giant robot that's killing some other giant world that is also part of a molecular structure of another robot. We're just a series of robots, like Russian dolls.
That's an interesting theory.
Yeah, you know,
really?
It's in the Bible. We're in Bible country.
Russian stacking.
We're in Bible country.
Still in the Bible.
Still in the Bible.
Still in the Bible country.
Let me read you a little bit of the Hamas charter, right? The Hamas charter, this is what they say their purpose is. It opens with a quote, Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. This is from the martyr Imam Hassan al-Banna of blessed memory, it says. This is a genocidal movement. This is a movement bent on destroying all the Jews. That's what it is. It is when people support Hamas, when people compare Hamas to Israel, they're comparing a free democratic state to a genocidal terrorist movement. That's what's happening, okay? All the other things that play into this, you could, if you were on the scene, if you were really educated about it, if you were really knowledgeable about it, you might say, oh, well, the court should have decided this. You might say, oh, well, you shouldn't march on Jerusalem Day. Actually, they canceled that march. You might say all kinds of things, but let's not be confused about the two sides. Israel is a sovereign democratic state. Hamas is a genocidal terrorist organization. I want to read you, as I say, racism is a specie of big think. And the greatest big think racism is anti-Semitism. Because when people start on anti-Semitism, they think the Jews control the world and are responsible for every single thing that happens in it. This is from the Hamas Charter. It is just a list of anti-Semitic tropes that have been around forever. For a long time, the enemies, meaning the Jews, have been planning skillfully and with precision for the achievement of what they have attained. They took into consideration the causes affecting the current of events. They strive to amass great and substantive material wealth, ooh, those rich Jews, which they devoted to the realization of their dream. With their money, they took control of the world media, news agencies, the press, publishing houses, broadcasting stations, and others. Ah, they've really got it figured out. You know, they've really honed this down to a complex series of details. It's the Jews! With their money, they go on, they stirred revolutions in various parts of the world with the purpose of achieving their interests and reaping the fruit therein. They were behind the French Revolution. I'll bet you didn't know that. I bet you thought the French were behind the French Revolution. They were behind the Communist Revolution and most of the revolutions we heard and hear about here and there. With their money, they formed secret societies such as Freemasons, Rotary Clubs, the Lions, and others in different parts of the world for the purpose of sabotaging societies and achieving Zionist interests. I mean, this is like listening to a guy raving in his mother's basement. This is the Hamas Charter. With their money, they were able to control imperialistic countries and instigate them to colonize many countries in order to enable them to exploit their resources and spread corruption there. It's all the Jews. You may speak as much as you want about regional and world wars. The Jews, they were behind World War I when they were able to destroy the Islamic Caliphate, making financial gains and controlling resources. They obtained the Balfour Declaration, formed the League of Nations through which they could rule the world. They were behind World War II, through which they were behind World War II. I get it. Let's wipe us all out. That'll help us take over the world. Through which they made huge financial gains, the ones who survived, by trading in armaments and paved the way for the establishment of their state. It was they who instigated the replacement of the League of Nations with the United Nations and the Security Council to enable them to rule the world through them. There is no war going on anywhere without them having a their finger in it. That is big think in a nutshell. It's all the Jews. If we can just convince you of that, you will become an angry, hateful, murderous person who will, because you think you're going to solve all the problems of the world. You want to see an example? Here's Rashid Tlaib, one of your congresswomen. Now, you may not have been able to hear that because she was screeching like a banshee through her mask. This is what she said. What they are doing to the Palestinian people is what they continue to do to our black brothers and sisters here. So I want you to know this. As you all are marching for freedom of Palestine, please know that you must be marching for everybody's freedom. It is all interconnected. Who is they in that sentence, Congresswoman? Who the hell is they? She's got it all figured out, too. They have all got it figured out. It's like these left-wing ideas, it's like every generation has to learn once again that these left-wing ideas make life worse. It is just amazing that we have to keep learning this. And you ask yourself, what is the appeal of these failed ideas? Why do they keep coming back? And I think it's what I call big think. It's the idea that somehow somebody, some expert, some central authority, maybe just the government in general, can get this great grasp over the big system that's going on and fix it. He's going to fix that big, it's that big system. You know, I'm going to quote myself. I wrote a novel, it was published in 1998, called The Uncanny. And one of the heroes of The Uncanny remarks, she says, little minds think great thoughts, but great minds proceed in the smallest stages. And I genuinely think that remark is true, that these people have this idea that they have this great picture of the world and they can adjust things. And if they can just turn this knob and turn that, and the little people in there don't really matter. See, I have this theory that the modern world of republicanism, of individual freedom, of capitalism, came into being in the wake of the discoveries of Isaac Newton. People don't really realize what a shock to the Western system the discoveries of Isaac Newton were, because they suddenly realized that God wasn't sitting around adjusting each little thing. He wasn't moving the planets with his hand. He wasn't doing each thing. He didn't have to. He made the world to work. And I think that kind of led over the decades and centuries to the idea that maybe the human world could work as well. Maybe that opened the human mind to this idea that, you know, an informed public could go about their business, and that would raise all ships, and everything would, and the market would work, and all this. That they didn't need a king like the king of heaven to play with each little thing and to tell people what to believe and what to think, and life would work much better. There would be fewer wars. There would be less fighting. There'd be less oppression if people just did what they did. But mankind repeats the original sin, just like human beings repeat the traumas of their youths. People who were abused in youth have themselves abused. People who had mean moms sometimes find mean wives. I mean, people repeat the traumas of their youths compulsively. And I think we repeat original sin. Remember, the original sin was that we wanted to be the determinants of good and evil, and we wanted to play God. And I think people want to play God, and they don't like the fact that God made a world for a freedom. They want to make sure that they're playing God, and they're going to adjust every little thing. You know, 2 years ago, I gave a speech at Boston College and a riot started. And literally, the police had to hustle me. I wouldn't leave until all the questions were over. But afterwards, the police hustled me out. And the people were just screaming. There's all these angry, angry children, essentially. It wasn't their fault. The administration, with the help of a tremendously dishonest reporter on the school newspaper, had incited them by quoting me out of context. They did it again. Like 2 weeks ago, they looked back on this and blamed the Republicans, the college Republicans, for inviting me in, that's what caused the riot. It wasn't the rioters. It wasn't the fact that the faculty and the administration had pumped stupidity into these kids' heads. It was my fault for having an opinion that disagreed. And this is what they wrote just a couple of weeks ago. They wrote, in November 2019, Boston College Republicans sponsored Andrew Klavan, who has promoted Islamophobia and claimed that European culture is superior to all other cultures. And he adds, these speakers actively discriminated against people, which is harmful to the affected populations and created a hostile divisive environment on campus. What a bunch of garbage. But anyway, their idea is that I said something wrong, that I'm Islamophobic. Islamophobic is just a propaganda word. But I have raised, I disagree with Islam. I'm a Christian. I think they're wrong about the nature of God in many, many ways. But also, I have wondered aloud and I have questioned whether some of the tenets of Islam are antithetical to Western ideas, like, for instance, the need for a theocracy, Sharia law. And I've questioned whether some of those the ideas in Islam might lead to the kind of violence of Islamism. I know there are millions and millions of lovely Muslim people. It has nothing to do with that. I've questioned the ideas. But their idea is, of course, this idea of racism, this idea of intersectional oppression. They have this big idea that if they can just move this person here and that person, it's all going to... They don't want to question the little details. When it comes to my comments about Europe, those were comments that were lifted out of my autobiography, my memoir, The Great Good Thing, where I said that the nations of Europe from the Renaissance to the First World War produced more of mankind's greatest artistic achievements than any others. That was the comment. And I won't go on to say, I despise racism. This is not about race. It's not a moral question. It's just that as the discoveries and calculus, reading from the book, as the discoveries and calculus of Newton are more important scientific breakthroughs than anything that came before or since, as the Constitution of the American Founders is the most profound piece of distilled political wisdom in all history, it makes simple sense that the artistic culture that underlay those advances that involved Shakespeare and Keats and Bach and Mozart, Michelangelo and Raphael, Cervantes and Dickens, all those things, that this was one of the greatest cultures that ever existed on Earth. And the final line of this is, this has nothing to do with whether these people were nice or decent or did good things. It only concerns the objects they made and left behind. Now, the left has this big think idea that somehow it's evil to talk about this because it's racial. All these people were white. Now, of course, they weren't all the same race. There were Spanish and French and British and, you know, they're in German, all these different races, in fact, but they all had the same color. And in big think, that's what matters. It's all about the color. So there's something wrong with saying one culture is better than another when I just think this is part of the human race. By the way, they weren't my race. I'm an Ashkenazi Jew. I had nothing to do. Our race, many of these people hated my race, but they think, oh, they've got it. It's the secret ingredient is the epidermis. You know, if you've ever read Thomas Sowell, Thomas Sowell is so brilliant. And the reason Thomas Sowell is so brilliant is because he has common sense. He's not like, you know, I don't know what his IQ is. I have no idea. But all he has is so much common sense that he's brilliant. And he talks about the fact that, for instance, Western culture in the West, in Europe, they had horses, they had oxen. So the Mayans invented the wheel, but they couldn't do anything with it. They invented the wheel. They put it on toys. They put it on children's toys. But in the West, in Europe, they could put it on carts because they had draft horses and oxen that would pull the carts. They could move material from place to place. They had navigable rivers, which you don't have in Africa. They could get from place to place. And they had great ideas. They had the Christian collision of Christianity with Aristotle and Plato, which became Thomas Aquinism and so shaped the thinking of the West and led to the prominence of reason and led to the freedoms that came after and kind of led to the ideas that made the West more free. You know, other cultures rose, like China rose, the Muslim culture rose, but they sank back again. And these were things that helped the Western culture, the culture of Europe, move forward. Little things, details, accidents. It can't be about genetics, because remember, the people who built Europe were the barbarians to the Greeks. These are the people that the Greeks and Romans called the barbarians. They would have said, oh, these are lesser races. But of course, there are no lesser races. Just so many accidents play into what happens in history. But they have this big think idea, this simple answer to complex questions that gives them the sense that they can have control of things. And it's all connected. Like racism, it always leads to racism because racism is a typical idea. But all these things are connected. The big think is kind of a virus that connects all things. What is our idea? What is the conservative idea? It's that each individual doing what he does will lift everybody up, that the world is made to work, that God made the world to work. Yes, because we live in original sin, because we're broken, we need laws to protect one another, to protect us from each other, so I don't cheat you or rob you or kill you. But we don't need people to lift up, to control the market. We don't need people to control our thoughts. We don't need people to control our language, to tell us what we can say. We don't need people knocking us off Twitter for putting forward things. We don't need to manipulate information to make sure you do what we want you to do. We just give you the information. We just teach you to think and then let you think for yourself, and the world is a better place. I just want to play, just to end this idea, I want to play one video that just really got me. This is Patrice Kolaris, who was a founder of Black Lives Matter. And she met a student who was at a book sale who was working to stop an anti-illegal immigration bill and was looking at her books. And this is what he said and how she reacted. This is cut one.
I was at our publications table today, and I was speaking to this young person from Arizona who's trying to fight SB 1070. And I was, he grabbed a book and he said, it's like Mal's Red Book. And I was like, man, that's what I was thinking. And it was just really cool to hear him make that connection. I was like, how about you buy like 10 to 15 of these books and you all have like a youth like organizing group where you talk about it and you really try to engage this. And we can just kind of, we need to build off of this.
She loved his goal. He compared me to Mao, who slaughtered tens of millions of people. And you know how Mao slaughtered people? He slaughtered them by telling them how much food they could grow in their ground, right? So that he destroyed the earth, he destroyed the food industry, people starved to death. He created a famine. He didn't mean to create a famine. He just said, because this is communism, we need to produce this much food, therefore you have to produce this much food. And people started, you know, lying about how much food they were producing, and it created this terrible famine that caused tens of millions of people. The racism of Black Lives Matter, and it is racism, and there's racism on the right, too. You get big thinkers on the right as well. The racism of Black Lives Matter and the big think of controlling the economy, they go together. They fit together. Our idea, the idea that we are defending, is the idea of freedom, that means some people are going to do bad things. It means some people are going to think bad things. It means some people are not going to like other people. It means some people are not going to want to associate with other people. But it also means that each person is going to produce what he thinks will make his life better and make all of our lives better in the process. It's the little things. It's little people doing little things that makes the world work. We do not need some human God to control us all. Big think is evil. Liberty is the antidote, where we just teach people what they need to know and let each one go his way.
Where in the world is Michael? I've been standing out here for half an hour.
Hey, Tom, look what I won on eBay.
Wow, Michael, what is it?
It's a DeLorean.
Is it like a time-traveling DeLorean?
Is there any other kind? Probably, but who cares? This one actually does travel back in time. And I'm going to take us on a fun trip.
Oh, I can't wait. Oh, maybe we could go meet Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, or go back to 1776, or even the Constitutional Convention. How about one of those things?
Boring. All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to take you back with me to the motherland.
Weren't you born in Russia?
No, Tom. The Soviet Union.
In my experience in particular, younger people have absolutely no idea about what communism was like, the scale and scope of the atrocities, the unbelievably scarlet crimes. They know nothing about it. Now, in a way, you can hardly blame them, because it's not as if the cultural establishment is going out of its way to inform them about these things. The popular view is that American journalists and intellectuals were, of course, opposed to Soviet communism, and they warned the world about this terrible threat. And some of them did, but many American intellectuals were cheerleaders of the Soviet system, or even openly on the Soviet team. It's almost to the point where it's become hip to be vaguely sympathetic to communism, or joke about it, or just not take it seriously.
Looking back at the horrors of communism, it makes people giggle instead of kind of go for tissue and want to cry. You'll see the Che Guevara shirts, but that's just a small part of it. If you talk about people fighting communism back in the day, it's kind of like, oh, this was silly, everyone was hysterical, it wasn't that big a deal. Well, it kind of is a big deal when literally every phone call you make someone is listening to, and when kids are taught at school to turn their parents into the police. While this was going on overseas in many countries for decades, in full force was the American excuse factory, just brushing aside all the horrors that were taking place and even pretending that things were wonderful. And this was a model for us to follow.
The best example of this was a journalist named Lincoln Steffens, who wrote for a publication called McClure's. In 1919, he went to Russia. He came back and he said, "I have been over into the future, and it works." Now, some historians say he wrote that line even before he left for Russia, so he was going to whitewash that place no matter what he saw. But it wasn't just him. It was a lot of American intellectuals who went over there and told us wonderful stories about how great everything was. So we had Jane Addams, we had Rexford Tugwell, who served under FDR, we had all these books coming forth, like The Challenge of Russia by Sherwood Eddy. Or how about this one, George Counts's The Soviet Challenge to America. Or how about this one, Maxwell Stewart, Where Everyone Has a Job. And in fact, John Dewey, the famous educator, said in the New Republic magazine in 1928 that, "I have never seen anywhere in the world such a large proportion of happy and intelligently occupied children." Then there's Oswald Garrison Villard, who was editor of The Nation magazine, which still publishes to this day. Despite not speaking Russian, never having met a Russian peasant, he still felt qualified to say in 1929, after more than a decade of one-party rule and concentration camps and systematic censorship, that what we were dealing with in Russia was what he called the social, moral, political, industrial, economic emancipation of a people.
My people had a very different approach to dealing with the atrocities of communism. Rather than make excuses for it, sometimes we made jokes. And here's how one of them goes. Khrushchev, who succeeded Stalin, is sitting at his desk. Things are going very badly for Nikita, but he's got a drawer that says, "In case of emergency, open me." He opens the drawer, and the first letter from Stalin says, "Blame everything on me." So he goes out and says everything bad that's happening was Stalin's fault. Things keep getting worse. People don't have food. The factories aren't producing. And across the ocean, the United States has elected a hunk for president. Khrushchev goes back to his desk, pulls open that drawer, reads that second letter, and it says, "Write two letters to your successor."
And the argument in Soviet Russia and the argument that their apologists in the West made was, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. But what's really disturbing about that quotation is those so-called eggs were the lives of tens of millions of people. And as someone else famously pointed out, where were the omelets?
Tom, how'd you like it if I invite you over to my house? And I said, "Tom, I'm going to make you a great, delicious breakfast. It'll be the kind of breakfast no one has ever seen before. It'll be the most stupendous breakfast ever undertaken. It's a whole new level of breakfast, and we're leaving the old ways behind."
I can't wait.
Okay, so breakfast isn't ready, but when you come for brunch, I'm going to have the best brunch you'll ever seen. It'll be stupendous. We're leaving the old ways of making brunch behind, and there's going to be so much food, you won't know what to do with yourself.
I'm going to get tired of all this winning.
Okay, here's the deal. Brunch isn't here, but if you come back for lunch, or possibly dinner, or maybe supper, I think that's different.
Michael, I waited till 2 o'clock in the morning. Where the f*** are my omelets?
You're still here? Sure, there were many American intellectuals who thought the Soviet experiment, as they called it, was something worth looking into, something that they thought had promise. That didn't necessarily mean, right, that they were literal communists taking orders from a foreign power dedicated to violently overthrowing the government.
Was there really infiltration of communists into the U.S. government? It's fashionable today to say that the very idea was a ridiculous conspiracy. We associate all this with Joe McCarthy to the point where we call it McCarthyism, the asking of questions about whether or not people are communists, particularly in sensitive positions in the U.S. government.
Not just communists in the sense of agreeing with communism, communists in the sense of being members of the Communist Party, a party which was getting its orders from a foreign power with the agenda of overthrowing the government, and doing so secretly. This is not a conspiracy theory, this was conspiracy history.
Well, as a matter of fact, in 1995, we finally got declassified what are known as the Venona Project files. They were made available to the American public, finally. These were a series of transcripts of thousands of Soviet intelligence messages from the 1940s, when at the time, the U.S. government had discovered a vulnerability inside Soviet intelligence transmission, and they captured a whole lot of these messages. It turns out that when you sift through them, 350 people in the U.S. government had relationships with Soviet intelligence. That's not a small thing. The Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Harry Dexter White, was certainly involved, as Venona shows, in inappropriate communications, to say the least, with Soviet intelligence. Also, Lawrence Duggan, who coordinated American relations with Latin America, and Lachlan Curry, who was a special assistant to FDR. These people are not minor individuals. These are significant figures. So this isn't some crazy theory somebody thought up. This was an actual problem.
Ronald Reagan was the first union president. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild. And part of his role was to figure out just how deeply communist agents had invaded Hollywood. And again, by communists, he meant people taking orders directly from a foreign government, not just those who simply had a different political point of view. And this was the actors who were worried about how much communism had taken root among their peers. This is where the expression card-carrying communist came from. They were members of a specific organization. And to this day, the technique used to fight the people who were fighting them was snark and humor. Oh, you're paranoid. No one's taking orders from a foreign power. This is all just a witch hunt. The problem is, there really were witches. And their schemes led to some very bad consequences, including stealing the plans for the deadliest weapon ever seen on Earth, the atom bomb, and handing it over to Stalin, one of the worst dictators the world had ever seen. What ended up happening is many of these former communists flipped and realized, wait a minute, I'm fighting for some really evil people. And they came forward, they outed their former colleagues, and to this day, they're portrayed as evil for pointing out which one of their peers were secretly taking orders from Moscow in order to destroy America. That was the goal.
The great celebrated case, of course, involved Alger Hiss, who'd been a U.S. State Department official, and Richard Nixon, who came to be hated after this particular episode, helped get him found guilty of perjury when he claimed that he had not known Whitaker Chambers. Whitaker Chambers had been part of the U.S. Communist Party, and he was one of the people who later flipped when he suddenly examined himself and realized he'd been on the wrong side.
What ended up happening is many of these former communists realized, wait a minute, I'm not fighting for any sort of emancipation at all. I'm fighting for the absolute totalitarian oppression of a people and a government that is intent on bringing their revolution to every country in the world. And to this day, investigating communism is regarded as the worst thing that's ever happened in American history. And then you turn on the TV and you hear that the Soviet Union, Russia, has influenced our elections in a way that apparently they never have in the past, or only started doing so in 2016.
All right, Michael, this is all well and good, but a lot of people, including journalists from the New York Times, the Washington Post, filmmaker Michael Moore, think that at least in theory, communism is about helping people and treating people equally. That on the one hand, we have the Nazis, Everybody in his right mind recognizes we're evil and genocidal and hyper-nationalistic and focused maniacally on racialist theories, but communism wasn't that way at all, because they just want to bring prosperity and happiness to everyone equally.
The thing is, everything works in theory. That's what makes it a theory. What if I told you both of these groups were really bad, and it's perfectly okay to condemn them both? You could still say these are evil ideologies that can never be allowed to take root. So here's the issue. To say it works in theory, you have to make the argument that people like Castro, people like Maduro in Venezuela today, Stalin, they weren't really communists. They didn't really mean what they were doing. They always say real communism has never been tried. Well, let's take a look at what fake communism looked like. Stalin took many different ethnicities from their ancestral homelands, forcibly repopulated them, killing lots of people along the way. This was a mechanism of breaking their spirits and maintaining social control. Toward the end of his life, years after the Holocaust, right before he died, Stalin was ready to unleash another pogrom against the Jews, something that the communists had condemned the Tsar for. The body count under the Soviets was very long. Millions of people over many years. This was later acknowledged by the Soviet Union, and this is the case in country after country. Pol Pot in Cambodia, the killing fields. It took 4 years in the 1970s. This wasn't that long ago. Killed between a fifth and a quarter of the entire population, including anyone who had eyeglasses, because this was a symbol of being an intellectual, and he wanted people to be rural. The death tolls of these regimes are enormous. So if country after country under communist rule has literal genocide, what does real communism mean, if not that?
And I might add, you have a lot of young people who think they're being hip and edgy wearing Che Guevara shirts. And of course, he was Fidel Castro's right-hand man in Cuba. They think this is a symbol of liberation. And at the same time, they've got their pride flags, their rainbow flags. Some people say Che executed homosexuals.
No, Tom, that's not exactly right. You're just repeating ridiculous conservative propaganda. Che sent gay people to forced slave labor camps. When he was murdering people, including, inevitably, some gay people, he was murdering people equally.
Wow, what a relief that is to hear, Michael, that he was absolutely non-discriminatory when it came to executing people. But sending gay people to camps, the idea there was that if they did really burly, manly work, this might purge them of their bourgeois deviation, namely homosexuality.
Well, did it work?
Well, Michael, as it turns out, putting people in prison does not, after all, lead to decreased homosexuality.
That Che, who so many young people wear in their shirts, had racial views that weren't exactly those of the NAACP.
Che said, "The Negro is indolent and spends his money on frivolities and booze, whereas the European is forward-looking, organized, and intelligent." Ouch.
So, Tom, what'd you think of the trip back to my motherland?
Well, not only would I not want to live there, it's not even a nice place to visit. And I'm still waiting on my f***ing omelet.
Real breakfast has never been tried.